It's time to head out on the front porch on KFRM. Grab your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy the conversation on the front porch.
Welcome to another edition of KFRM's On the Front Porch. I'm Jamie Bloom, your host for today, and I'm so excited about the guests that I have on the phone with me. Sherry Monahan is an author, food editor, and I found Sherry through True West magazine, and I'm just so excited she's joining me. Sherry, thank you for taking time out of your schedule to visit with me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sherry, on your website that I looked at this morning, you are described... Let's see here. There's a long list of things that you have done. You've appeared on a lot of different TV documentaries. You've written a lot of different books. You're a regular contributor to True West magazine, which is, by the way, is my new favorite magazine. It just randomly came to our station one day. And my dad is a really huge Wild West fan and loves to read. So I subscribed to the magazine.
Great.
And then I read it before I give it to Dad. So we figured that out. That worked out pretty good. And I found you in there and had seen an article you'd written and just thought it looked like so much fun that I thought, I've got to call her or try. And I guess I found you on Facebook and see if you were willing to do an interview. So
well, here's a shocker, a writer who likes to talk about her stuff. So
yeah, exactly. Well, and you have a lot of it. So you're listed here. You are the president of Western Writers of America. You hold memberships in Women Writing the West, the James Beard Foundation, the Authors Guild, National Women's History Museum, the Wild West History Association, and you've done a lot of genealogy work as well, the National Genealogical Society and Association of Professional Genealogists. So along with publishing several different books on cooking and the Victorian West. But in this first segment, Sherry, I really just want to find out a little bit more about you personally and how you came to love food and love history and how you figured out how to put them together to write these great books. So,
sure. I do just want to make one small correction. I think my website, and if it's not right, I need to fix that, is I am the immediate past president of Western Writers of America.
Okay. Well, yeah, this was probably just a little behind there. But
okay. Anyway, yeah. I will look into that. But no, I stepped down last June. So, okay. But it's a great organization, and I'm very happy to be on the board still. But so for me, my passion for food in the West, and it's really kind of interesting, I think most people find, is that I grew up in New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
My parents are from upstate New York. And until later in their life, my family and we never set foot past Illinois.
Really? No family vacations to the Wild West or anything like that?
No, we always vacationed in Maine or in the New England, and my relatives were all in upstate New York, so we spent a lot of time on the Finger Lakes near the wineries, but I was too young to appreciate them at that point.
Sure.
And the funny thing, though, is that my dad loved all things Western, like a lot of men of his generation at that time.
Mm-hmm.
When he grew up, playing cowboys and Indians. And when I was growing up, he always had a Stetson cowboy hat. He wore cowboy boots. He had the big old belt buckle. He had the bolo necktie.
Yeah.
My dad was in every sense a cowboy in the way he dressed.
So this was in New Jersey. So did he stand out a little bit?
Just a wee bit.
Okay.
But he didn't care.
Sure.
He loved it. And, you know, we always watched Westerns. And mm-hmm. So I think my appreciation of the West came from my dad.
Okay.
And at one point, my sister moved to Texas. And I went out there and got really interested in the West, and coupled with my dad and TV shows and movies. Mm-hmm. And I ended up with my husband one year going to the Grand Canyon, ended up going to Tombstone, Arizona, and just mm-hmm. fell in love with Tombstone. There's mm-hmm. just something about the place. I always say I think I lived there in another life.
Yeah.
You know, that I was Wyatt Earp and he was Doc Holliday, you know.
Well, I noticed you've written several books about Tombstone.
I have, and that was my first love of the West.
Okay.
And I'm a foodie. Out of sheer sustainability, I think. My mom, and God love her, and she will not disagree, is that she's not a good cook.
Okay. All right. Well, I can relate with her then.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's my dad neat, was though. The cook, and he came from a family of bakers. My grandfather was the baker at a lumber camp in upstate New York,
really?
So
wow.
They all baked.
Okay.
But when I was in junior high school, there was the home economics class, and I loved to cook. And my mom didn't care. She was happy that I wanted to get in the kitchen.
Yeah, Sherry, go ahead. Cook all you want, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about it. I got this. You go.
Yeah.
So it was really because my mom didn't cook and I found it fun, creative, that's sort of how the two things in my younger life, the food and the West, sort of came out. And then when I went to Tombstone, all of that sort of came to a head when I said, you know, I love this place. I want to be connected to it somehow. Maybe I should write a book. And I had never written. I used to write for the high school paper.
Okay.
I wanted to be a journalist, but just didn't end up going that route.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at the time working for Travelers Insurance, which was GE, and I was writing policy and procedure manuals.
Yeah, not so interesting, right?
Yeah, a little boring. So when I got to Tombstone, I got to thinking, well, I could write a book, but I'm not writing about the OK Corral. Oh, my gosh, that's way over my head.
Uh-huh.
And then I started thinking, well, what did they eat back here? You know, what did they eat when Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday lived here?
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of led me on my quest to my first book, Taste of Tombstone.
All right. So how do you go about starting to research and figure out what they ate back then?
You know, I'm working on another book right now called California Madams, and I have a monthly column in True West called Frontier Fair that I've had for, I think it's 6 or 7 years now. I'm so lucky to be able to be a feature editor for them, which is awesome. So when I do my research today, I was just thinking about this the other day. It was when I first started my research back in 1997 for my first book. I had a full-time job at GE, and I had to borrow, through interlibrary loan, reels of microfilm of the old newspapers from Tombstone. And at my lunch hour, I would go and sit at the library microfilm machine, and I would just scroll through and print pages at 25 cents a piece.
Wow.
Pages. And that's how I did my research. And then I would go to the Arizona Historical Society, you know, one time, and cull as much information as I could in a week's time because, you know, travel's expensive.
Right.
And that's how I researched back then. And you relied on the kindness of researchers and strangers at historical societies to go and photocopy something for you and to help you research. And that's kind of how you did it old school.
Before the internet. It's amazing, isn't it, how far we've come? I mean, really, you know, with not only researching that type of thing, but researching genealogy and things like that, the internet has just made such a huge difference.
It has. I mean, you know, here I sit in my office in North Carolina, and I use these, you know, a couple of paid subscriptions for newspapers online, and I am able to do a word search. You know, where before I had to look through the whole paper, read every story,
right.
Which was fun because you would find nuggets for other stuff and you can still do.
Sure.
But it just cut your research time substantially.
Wow. Well, Sherry, going back to growing up, now you talked about how your mom wasn't the best cook. And like I said, I can relate with her. I can get food on the table for the family every night. I'm just not always very creative about it. And the baking, I don't do much of the baking. I always say my sister got all of those genes from mom, and I didn't. But what were some of your favorite foods when you grew up that maybe your dad, you said your dad was the cook in the family. What kind of things did you love as you grew up?
You know, I'm a bread person.
Yeah. I'm with you there. I do love food, and I do love to eat. I'm not a great cook, but I love to eat everybody else's cooking. So
exactly.
Yeah.
There was one recipe that my mom made, and it was one of my dad's older sister's recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Aunt Mabel's Spanish rice.
Okay.
Yeah. There was nothing Spanish about it. Not in the world of today and what you would think of, but it was the one thing my mom made really, really good, and we all got excited when mom said, we're having Spanish rice for dinner.
It didn't by chance have fried egg in it, did it?
It did not.
Okay. My mom made a rice recipe with fried egg in it that was always really good. So
now, see, that would be like a Chinese style fried rice.
Okay,
I think of eggs and rice.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But it was good. I mean, it had peppers, tomatoes, rice, and ground beef, and a tablespoon of yellow mustard for flavoring.
That sounds delicious, actually.
It was. I still make it today. It's like one of those comfort foods from your childhood.
Right. Yeah, we all have those, and it's fun to pull those recipes out, I think, sometimes, and make them again, because, you know, you kind of get away from things like that sometimes.
You do. And it's interesting how, you know, there's scents and sounds that have total recall on certain things for you. Like there's a certain song that will make you remember a certain time period. Mm-hmm. And I think there's food. Food does the same thing. I've had people, when my Taste of Tombstone came out years ago, people would come up to me and say, oh, my gosh, you've got a recipe in there that looks just like my great-grandmother's. Or, you know, so it brings back memories for people.
And
hopefully
all
good ones.
Yeah, a lot of those recipes were handed down generation after generation. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're still around today.
Yep.
Well, Sherry, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit more about the Taste of Tombstone and what kinds of foods they had in Tombstone back then. So
sounds good.
We'll be back on the front porch with Sherry Monahan in just a couple minutes. Back on KFRM's On the Front Porch, I'm Jamie Bloom and interviewing Sherry Monahan today. Sherry has written several books about cowboy cooking, historical food, wine. I know you're a wine connoisseur as well, Sherry. We're gonna get to that a little later in the interview because I am too. So
good.
But one of the things that Sherry is really an authority on is Tombstone, Arizona. And you said that was kind of the first city that you visited that got you really interested in Western cooking and food in that area.
It did.
So.
It did.
The thing that I noticed in just looking a little bit at what you'd written before on Tombstone is how much food they actually had there that I would never have dreamed they would have had back in those days.
That is true. When I first started doing my research, I really expected, you know, I think most people, when you think about the Old West, you think of the chuck wagon and chili and beans and biscuits and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
And that's really what I expected.
Exactly.
And so when I first started looking at my first menus and bills of fare, as they were called back in the day, I was shocked that I was looking at classic French food.
And was some of that because of the immigrants that were coming to that area?
No, it really had to do with what was trendy. You have to remember the one thing that a lot of people don't put two and two together is this was what I like to call the Victorian West. Mm-hmm. And the Victorian era happened at the exact same time as the West was being settled. And so people that were here on the East Coast, you know, were very trendy. They were following what was going on in Europe. Well, in the 19th century, around the 1870s and 1880s and up to 1890s, classic French food was all the rage. It was the words that they used back in the day was bon ton and tony. And if you weren't serving classical French food at your establishment, then you were not one of the upper crust people. And so the menus were even printed in French.
Really?
Up until about 1880 in Tombstone, when one of the Grand Hotel finally wised up and changed it, and even the newspaper said, well, it's about time.
Really? Because nobody could understand what they were ordering?
I often wonder that. It's like, did you just look at the menu, you know, and all these French terms and just point at it, or did you just wait for the waitress to bring out a plate and go, yeah, I want that.
Yeah, that looks good. I'll just take that. So
that
we see that
good.
In movies
that.
Where people do that. They just they can't tell what it is, so they just say, yes, I'll have that.
Exactly. I mean, or maybe they just knew what, you know, salmon baked a la Richelieu meant. I have no idea. I just think it's very interesting. Or maybe it just said salmon and they just were like, I'm game. Let me have salmon.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned to me that if a city had a railroad coming through it, that they had access, as long as they had the money to pay for it, to about anything they wanted.
Either a railroad, because Tombstone didn't have a railroad until much later.
Mm-hmm.
The closest railroad was eventually in Benson, Arizona, which was 5.5 hours by stagecoach. So any supplies that they got had to come on a stage. So you have to think about oysters.
Yeah, how did they keep them fresh?
How did they get them in 5.5 hours in the heat of the summer? If you had money, you know, you could definitely afford anything. And businesses and mercantile shops wanted to have everything that money could buy. Having a railroad, you didn't necessarily have to have money, but you had to have access to get supply. So you have to have a supply either by train or by stagecoach. But there were lots of towns that, you know, could have a stagecoach come to them, but they didn't have money. So they would have had the basic staples of, you know, meat, potatoes, you know, wheat, flour to make bread, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas Tombstone or, say, Dodge City, where they had money, or Deadwood was another mining community, is that there was a lot of money. People wanted to be trendy. They didn't want to think just because they were out in the hills of the Dakota Territory or out in Arizona Territory that they didn't have sophisticated standards like the people in San Francisco or in New Orleans or New York City did. So they would have oysters. Oysters were very trendy. Oftentimes they came in cans, but in certain seasons they were able to get imported ones from Baltimore. So, yeah, money and transportation, you know, kind of had a dual role and supplies that people would have.
Well, so what are some of the favorite recipes maybe that you would have featured in your books about Tombstone that people would have had back then?
The one thing that my favorite recipe in Tombstone, Taste of Tombstone, is baked apple dumplings. It basically was a whole apple. You cored it out, you filled it in with brown sugar and butter, and then you wrapped it around some pie crust. I mean, how could you go wrong?
Exactly. That sounds good. I'd take that today.
So. Right? I mean, it's pie. Who does not like pie?
Yeah, no kidding. What about recipes maybe that they made back then that would not be made today? Something that's, you know, just not so popular anymore that was trendy then.
Vinegar pie.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't sound very good.
No. Vinegar pie really was created to replace lemon pie. Lemon pie was very popular back in the day, and it still is. But it was just really, really – coconut and lemon were like two exotic flavors, you know, that people couldn't get. They were just thought of them as being something exotic and were very popular on menus. And so when you didn't have lemons or lemon juice, they substituted vinegar. And it was one of the first recipes. I test all of my recipes so that I know that they work because they're 19th century recipes.
Right.
And so I tested the vinegar pie recipe. My husband, God love him, he tasted it and he was like, please don't make me eat ever again. Don't ever make this recipe again.
It's one for the trash, right?
Well, it was like, fine, it's historical and you can share it and you made it to test it, but not again.
Oh, wow.
But I guess, you know, when you were desperate for supplies or something similar, you kind of went, okay.
What do you think the price of a vinegar pie would have been in Tombstone in the mid-1880s?
Well, the thing, they didn't actually sell things individually too much. I think at a bakery shop, you probably would have paid, I don't know, maybe 25 cents for a pie.
A pie?
But a whole menu, you know, the term soup to nuts is not just a term we use. It was literally a way to describe what was on a bill of fare. And they literally started the meal with soup and they ended with nuts.
Really?
And so you would have soup, you would have a fish course, you would have a meat course, you could have a roast course, you would have vegetables, you would have dessert, you would have pastry and pie. And all of that in Tombstone at the height of everything was anywhere from 25 to 50 cents per meal.
Wow. So you
and
got
when you think about it,
all those
miners
courses.
Who spent all day in the mines earned anywhere from $3 to $4 a day. Just to give you an idea of how much a meal would cost versus your day's salary.
That's a lot of courses. So,
yeah.
So serving sizes probably weren't huge, though, if you were eating all of that, right?
I wouldn't think so. But I, you know, I don't have anything to any evidence that says, okay, this is the size plate they used or this is the size portion. But you would think that if you're going to have all of those courses that they would be much smaller than just the one plate of food we'd get today.
Yeah. So that's what was happening within the city of Tombstone at that time.
Mm-hmm.
What else was going on in Tombstone in the mid-1880s?
Well, of course, the reason that Tombstone exists and was even founded was because of silver that was found in the hills by Ed Shiflin. And so they were there mining silver. And so a day in Tombstone, you know, it's not a big town. You've got, you know, three main thoroughfares and then maybe four numbered streets where the gist of everything happened. And of course, you would have had in the behind the town all of the hoisting works and the milling, and so it was very noisy. I mean, there were things stamping out the rock to extract the silver, so you had the stamp mills, and they were banging, 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 which today we would go, oh, my God, the noise.
Yeah, right.
But back then it was, oh, the noise, it's money.
Right, yeah.
It's the survival of the town.
All right.
It would have been dusty. They actually had a truck that would sprinkle the streets with water to keep the dust down.
What about gambling in saloons? Lots of that going on in Tombstone?
Oh, yes. As with any Western town, there were saloons, there were gambling, there were dance halls. Faro, of course, was the game of the day. If you've seen the movie Tombstone, you'll see Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp are playing Faro or dealing Faro. It was a very respectable job to have as a gambler.
Mm-hmm.
You took a portion of the, you would set up your little shop in a saloon. You didn't own the saloon. You would take your faro table and your whole kit into the saloon, and whatever you won, the owner of the saloon would take a small portion of it.
And, along that line, Sherry, I thought of something else. I'm trying to remember what it was now. In the saloons, besides the alcohol, obviously, that they were serving, did they serve food in saloons as well, or was that saved more for the high-class restaurants?
No, they did. A lot of saloons, if you think about it today, they put out salty food. They would have salty snacks. They would have nuts. They would have, some had pickled herring. Some places had pâté de foie gras.
Oh, really?
More high-end establishment, but they would offer salty food like you do today so that your patrons drank more.
So bar food really existed even back then?
It did. And a lot of times they would import lunches. They would call them imported lunches from a local restaurant. So if you wanted to, stand at this. Now, remember, there are no chairs and tables in saloons. So you're at the bar. You're standing at a bar.
Really?
And there may have been a table in the back for reading newspapers and a friendly poker game. But when you walked into a saloon, you would have seen faro tables. You probably could have seen a roulette wheel, some other random money wheel games, that kind of thing, but not big old tables like you see in the movies.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, Sherry, we're going to take another break, and we'll come back and visit a little bit more about Wild West cooking with Sherry Monahan in just a moment. Back with you on the front porch. I'm Jamie Bloom, visiting this morning with the author Sherry Monahan. Sherry's written books like Mrs. Earp. Now, Sherry, that one, not so much a cooking book, right?
No recipes at all. Really, it's a story about all of the women who called themselves Mrs. Earp throughout the Earp's lives. I figured, all the men get all the attention, so why not share information about all the women?
It looks like a really good book. I just checked that one out on Amazon this morning, so that one looked like fun. And of course, we talked about the Tombstone books that you have written. A Taste of Tombstone is one of those. Tombstone's Treasure, another one. And you are working on some new books. You had one come out last year that we wanted to talk a little bit about, The Cowboy's Cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about what's in that one.
The Cowboy Cookbook it's really an interesting book because I think most people, when they think about cowboys, they think of the chuck wagon grub.
Right.
And that is true, is they did eat a certain type of food on the trail or when they were out during roundup. But when they were living on the ranch or when they got at the end of their cattle drive and they ended up in places like Dodge City where they whooped it up, they were eating a lot of those types of foods we talked about earlier, like they had in Tombstone, the classic French foods and the fancy meals, because Dodge City, of course, catered to the cowboys. Of course, they had money, they had everything, and the cowboys wanted to spend. So the variety of food that a cowboy ate really did sort of, run the gamut of everything from basic home cooking to the classic foods as well.
So it wasn't beans at every meal.
It was not. If they were on the trail, yes, unfortunately.
It probably was.
But, sometimes, they would always have beef, of course. A lot of times it wasn't beef from their own herd. They may have taken a cow from another herd.
Sure.
Why butcher your own money?
Yeah, no kidding.
And, you know, they didn't have eggs, very rare because, of course, they were so fragile they couldn't travel in the chuck wagon box. But mm-hmm. If there was a local farmer nearby, every once in a while, the cookie, as they called the chuck wagon cook, you know, would maybe bargain for some eggs.
Okay.
So they would have a rare treat, but that was not the norm. It was, you know, beans and biscuits and beef. You know, there are three words that if I said to you, you know, would you like some sop, lick, and sinkers? And you'd probably look at me and go,
right.
What?
Yeah, I would have no idea what that is. So tell
right.
us, what
you
is
know,
that?
The cowboys had their own lingo, and there's actually a section in the book, a page or two, that has cowboy lingo, which is really fun. Basically, sop was gravy.
Okay.
Lick was some kind of syrup or sorghum, and sinkers were biscuits.
Okay. I've never
so
heard them
called
that
normal
before.
Sounding yummy food, but not the way they pronounced or what they called it.
So how did you research this book? Where did you find all of this?
You know, the newspapers, old newspapers are a great source of information, you know, for bills of fare, you know, fun cowboy stories, which I found in there. And then there's a lot of accounts from cowboys who told stories later in their lives about what life was like out on the cattle trails. So I called that information. So that's basically the sources of the information where I got all the information, all the stories.
Do you take some trips once in a while to do some research?
I do. There's nothing like, as I say, boots on the ground and to touch and hold documents or menus or stories or, you know, hotel bills or bills of lading that you just go, wow, somebody back from the 1800s touched this at one point, you know?
Yeah. Oh, how interesting. Well, it says here that there are recipes in the book like elk steak, squash cakes, stewed chicken. So it wasn't always beef. Sometimes they were eating different types of meats.
That is true. And they had fish too. If they had mm-hmm. The trail, they happened to camp near a stream or a lake, they might fish. That was not always, but you know, they definitely had a variety of things, you know, on the trail depending on where they were.
So you've adapted a lot of these recipes so that we can make them at home in our own kitchens?
Absolutely. Like I said before, I test the recipes. There's also a conversion in the book, too. If you want to make it old school, like on a chuck wagon mm-hmm. or outdoors, there is a way to cook in a Dutch oven, very detailed about what temperature and how many briquettes you need under and how many you need over, where you could mm-hmm. bake or cook mm-hmm. In the book as well. So you could kind of have a little fun if you wanted to be adventurous or if you're a chuck wagon person. You know, you go out and you do chuck wagon events.
Well, can you think of a few more recipes that might be in there that would be maybe something different that we wouldn't have thought of making, you know, in this day and age, something old fashioned?
You know, there's something that was called, if the cowboys out on the cattle trail had a dessert, it wasn't all the time, it was a treat. Mm-hmm. And there was something called Duff, D-U-F-F.
Okay.
And it's kind of like what we would call a cobbler or mm-hmm. It's like a cobbler. Basically, you have fruit in the bottom. If there was fruit nearby, like if there were raspberries or blueberries were in season and the cookie could find them and pick them, mm-hmm. basically they would, you know, sprinkle some sugar on the berries and put a biscuit topping over the top and bake it.
Sounds pretty good.
But yeah. Just a different name. You know,
right.
They had that. And, of course, you would have the vinegar pie again.
Oh, yeah.
and gallons of coffee.
So they always carried lots of coffee with them.
They did. It was most of the time it was Arbuckle mm-hmm. coffee.
Okay. I don't know what that is.
Arbuckle coffee, they were the first to, before Arbuckles decided to roast the coffee and package it up in bags, mm-hmm. you would have to buy the green beans. You would roast your own beans, and then you would grind your own beans. And so Arbuckles were the first ones, and that's why it was called the cowboy coffee, because it was already roasted. All you had to do is grind it, and mm-hmm. the beans, you know, could last. They didn't go bad. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very popular drink. And, of course, you know, you wanted your cowboys to stay awake in the saddle. Mm-hmm. So, you know, coffee was the beverage of choice.
All right. So it sounds like the cook not only was cooking along the trail, but was also looking for food all the time, wherever they were. Whether, like, you know, as you mentioned, maybe they find berries somewhere, or they go and fish, or they were kind of in charge of continuing to add to the food supply as they went along?
He was the procurement officer, let's say that.
Okay.
He could also have been their mother, their nursemaid, the doctor. Mm. There was no whiskey allowed on the trails.
Really?
It was extremely forbidden. The only person that was allowed to have whiskey was the cookie. And that was more for medicinal purposes than anything else. Mm-hmm. And if you got caught taking any of that, you were in big trouble.
Well, it sounds like the cookie had quite the big job, honestly.
He did. He did.
And how many days at a time do you think they were out?
They were usually out on the trail about 3 months.
That's a long time to have to, mm-hmm. to take enough supplies and gather enough food and keep going. So.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Well, so that's the cowboy cooking book that we were talking about there. Let's talk about a book that you have coming out soon you've been working on that's going to cover all the holidays in the year. Tinsel, Tumbleweeds, and Star-Spangled
Celebrations.
Sounds great. What kinds of things will be in that one?
It comes out in October, mm-hmm. and there are a few recipes in there. There's also some instructions on how to play some Victorian games. There's decorating tips. I like to think of it as it's a kind of a how-to. Like if you wanted to celebrate your holiday Victorian West style, this book will help you do it. There are gift-giving ideas, recipes for like a romantic Valentine's Day or how to decorate for Valentine's Day, some poems, some songs for the 4th of July, stories from people who celebrated, just a lot of fun stuff. I like to think of it as a how-to for back in the 19th century out west.
Well, tell me a little bit more about the Victorian West and that. I've not really heard that description until today and visiting with you. You know, you always hear about the Wild West and think of it as being pretty rough. But to put the word Victorian with West, you know, what does that description really mean?
For me, it means that the people that went out West were not all rough and tumble cowboys mm-hmm. and prostitutes.
Sure.
And I think that image, you get that image when you see most of the movies or TV shows.
Right.
Or they're very backward, you know, simple folk.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
while you do have all of those elements in the West, you also have a ton of people that packed up their homes from Connecticut, from Georgia, from, mm-hmm. you know, Tennessee, and they all went West. Well, those people living here out in the East, we're all living in a proper Victorian society, okay? I think people, when you hear Victorian, you think either England or Victorian America, you mm-hmm. know, people are having tea, they have calling cards, and they have proper etiquette, right?
Right, right.
So when you think about the West, you don't think any of that. So I always say is that all of these people with their Victorian virtues and values did not, when they got to the Mississippi River, go, that's all out the window today. You know, it's what they knew. It was their life. It wasn't just a switch they could flip off and on. So when you have all of these immigrants going West, they're Victorian West pioneers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will, you have to understand, of course, too, that there were certain things that you couldn't do that you would have been, you know, shamed for in the East. Like, mm-hmm. you know, a woman, you know, would never have, you know, had only one dress. You know, mm-hmm. but when you went out West, a lot of poor immigrants, they tried to pack their entire house. And when they got on the trail was scattered with pianos and china mm-hmm. and dresses and clothes and furniture because they were weighing down their animals.
And they couldn't do it. They couldn't take it.
They
all
couldn't
with them.
Take it. And so it was literally littered with possessions of people. So when you got out West, okay, you may have had one dress for Sunday church and mm-hmm. for a fancy event, and you had your working dress. Well, no woman on the East Coast, a proper Victorian woman, would have been without at least 10 dresses.
Wow, yeah.
So, you know, you did have to adjust your mm-hmm. standards, but mm-hmm. you still had proper etiquette. You still had proper manners. You just didn't throw all that out the window at the mm-hmm. Mississippi.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very interesting. Well, Sherry, we're going to take another break and come back and talk about a couple more of the books that you have coming out for us soon. I know you're kind of a wine connoisseur, too. I wanted to cover that. So
sure.
We'll talk about that when we come back on the front porch. Back on the front porch here on KFRM, I'm Jamie Bloom. And Sherry Monahan joins me today. Sherry, I've so enjoyed our visit so far. In the last segment, we talked a little bit about how whiskey and alcohol was not really allowed on the trail with the cowboys. But there were definitely areas of the country where it was. You've actually got a book coming out that's going to talk a little bit about that.
I do. Another book coming out in October is called The Golden Elixir of the West.
Mm-hmm.
And it really talks about whiskey and its role in settling the West. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting when you stop and think about whiskey. You know, when you see a movie or you hear the West, you always think of whiskey.
Right.
Why not rum? Why not gin?
Right. Yeah.
And so the whole purpose of the book was to really discuss that. Is like, okay, why? How did whiskey make it out West? Why was that the most popular thing?
Right.
And it really comes down to the American Revolution. You know, rum was the most popular ardent spirit, as they called it back then.
Mm-hmm.
And when the taxes became really high on the sugar, you know, people were looking for other ways to come up with a beverage. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of grain growing in America.
That's right. Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, grain and corn, wow, we can mm-hmm. make whiskey right here in America. We don't have to pay any taxes on it. We don't have to buy any sugar, you know, not like you use in rum. And so whiskey sort of just became the American spirit, really, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people started going west, and the other thing about whiskey is that whiskey is the most easily adulterated product without you knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to make a spinoff of a rum or of a vodka or a gin, you're going to taste that, you know, because they're pretty distinct and mild flavors.
Mm-hmm.
With whiskey, you know, you could buy a really good product, or you could make one out of moonshine, plug tobacco juice, and, you know, some burnt sugar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you wouldn't know that you're not drinking the good stuff. Hence the movies that show, I want some of the good stuff.
Right, yeah.
I don't want the rot gut. Literally would rot your gut because sometimes it was made with kerosene, which is, of course, deadly.
Right.
And could cause all kinds of problems. But so whiskey, I mean, the book really just sort of talks about that. There are, you know, some great chapters in there that really follow, you know, Lewis and Clark, mm-hmm. who took whiskey as rations for the men, all the way up until, you know, the settlers, the mining communities, the cow towns, and how whiskey was involved in all of those. You know, there's some great firsthand stories. I mean, probably one of my most favorite books so far that I've written, with the fun stories of people, in Tombstone, the first mm-hmm. massive fire they had in 1881 was because of a bad barrel of whiskey was being hauled off, and it caught fire and then, you know, leveled most of the town.
Wow.
So, you know, whiskey and how the railroads, you know, between whiskey and the railroads, the two of them sort of intertwined together. And, you know, I talk about the Hell on Wheels towns.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, sort of, there's that TV show that was on. It sort of, you know, it really talks about the truth and what really happened in those towns. So it's just a great book. There's a few cocktail recipes in there.
Mm-hmm.
I created a signature cocktail called the Golden Elixir of the West. That's in there, too.
Well, tell us a little bit about that recipe.
Well, that recipe, I know you're going to be shocked to hear it, but whiskey is the first ingredient.
All right. What's your favorite? What would you use?
Well, in this recipe, it is, I co-wrote the book with the woman who is part owner of High West Whiskey in
okay.
Park City, Utah.
Okay.
And so I use High West.
All right. Okay. That's okay. We can put a little plug in for her.
But I love High West. They have some really great whiskey, so I use that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add in some triple sec, some agave syrup, some fresh squeezed lime juice, and orange juice. And then you strain it all together. Mix it all together with ice, and then you strain it, and then you serve it with an orange peel.
That sounds good. The Golden Elixir.
Yeah, very refreshing.
West. Yeah. All right. And again, that book's coming out in October.
Yeah.
I know with your books that are coming out this fall, you have some book signings coming up actually here in Kansas. So tell us a little bit about the places you'll be and when.
Well, I will be in Missouri, but I think you said that's not too far from Kansas.
It's not, no.
Yep. Okay. So we are, I am a proud member of the Most Intrepid Western Author Posse. And every year, a few of my fellow Western Writers of America members, we form the posse, and we'll go out and do some book signings and have a little fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so this year, we are going to be on June 17th, which is a Saturday. We're going to be at the Robideau Rowe Museum in St. Joe from 4 to 6 p.m. doing some book signings.
Okay.
And then on June 18th, on Sunday, we will be at the Barnes & Noble in Independence from noon to 1 signing our books.
All right. Independence,
so if any
Missouri,
of you out there that
right?
are in that area, yeah. come on out and see us.
Okay. Awesome. All right, Sherry, we wanted to talk a little bit about wine. I wanted to make sure we covered that because I know you're kind of a wine lover like I am. I saw one segment on your website where you were talking about old-fashioned wines. So tell us where your interest came from.
I like wine.
That's about as deep as mine goes, too. So,
I like wine, and my husband and I, on Saturdays, there's a few wine shops in our area, and we'll mm-hmm. go out and we'll do some grocery shopping, and then we go, you know, wine tasting. Mm-hmm. And there was this one wine shop that we walked in there, and the people, the owners, we knew them, and they knew that I had written, you know, Western books. Mm-hmm. And the guy said to me, oh, my gosh, you're going to love the wine we're tasting today. It was a Segacio Brothers wine and one of the old Zinfandels, which is one of my favorite varietals. And he said, you're going to love this because, you know, the history and the Old West, and started to tell me the history about this guy who came over and ended up working at a winery for the Italian Swiss wine colony. Then he ended up opening his own winery. And I got to thinking, well, if there's one cool story mm-hmm. about a historic winery out in California, there's got to be more.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So you started your research.
You got to love that kind of research, right?
No kidding. Yeah.
I mean, I would have, I would talk to wineries and I would ask them, you know, what's their, I wanted readers to be able to go, and there are over 60 wineries that are still in business today in California that have some kind of a historical tie, either old vines or it's an old winery. Mm-hmm. And I wanted my readers to be able to go out and buy a historical bottle. You know, what is your most historical wine is what I would ask them. And some of them you can only order from the winery. Some of them you can get locally in your stores. So they would send me a bottle or two or three.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I wanted to sample them. I would not want my readers to be drinking bad wine.
That's right. You have to approve them and make sure it's what you want to promote. So
exactly. And so my first shipment was from Buena Vista Winery, who is one of my favorite wineries, one of the oldest in Sonoma. And they sent me about a half a case of wine. And the UPS guy came to my door and he said, oh, just got a trip back from California. And I was like, well, yes, I did. But these are for research for a book. And he looked at me and went, okay. And for about a month, almost every day, either the UPS guy or the FedEx guy was at my door with a box. At one point, they almost backed into each other in my driveway.
Oh, no.
And every time the UPS guy would walk up to the door, he'd wink at me and go, research, right?
More research. That's right. That's great. So this led to your book about California vines, wines, and pioneers. Is that right?
Yes. It did. And the really cool thing is it's broken down by regions mm-hmm. so that if you're out wine tasting or you're planning a trip to California, you can get the book and go, oh, yeah, I want to go to this historic place. And you'll know the history behind it and the people that started the winery. And there's about 25 recipes in there as well from those historic wineries, historic recipes mm-hmm. from families who had handed them down.
Oh, that sounds great.
You got to pair food and wine, right?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. That sounds like another one that I'm going to have to check out. So, well, one more question that I had for you today, Sherry. I wanted you to tell me what your favorite character from the Old West would be that you've written about. What would you say?
Oh, there's lots of them. You know, I always find someone who, in each book, I always find somebody that just sort of speaks to my heart.
Mm-hmm.
In my Mrs. Earp book, there are two of the wives for different reasons. I know you said one, but I'm going to break
sure.
your rule and say
that's
two.
That's fine. Absolutely.
Allie Earp was married to Virgil Earp. She was his last wife.
Mm-hmm.
And Allie was a spunky little Irish lass who, every time I would find a story about her, she would make me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter what happened in her life, she was, her father died in the Civil War or ran off. We don't really know. Her mother died a year later. Her and her multiple siblings were spread out in foster homes, and she did not have a happy life in foster homes. And because mm-hmm. she was so outspoken, most of the time her foster parents dumped her. And she ended mm-hmm. up working as a waitress. You know, she never, as far as my research showed, was a prostitute. So, you know, Allie, God love her, she just didn't matter. Nothing kept her down, and she kept her head up high, and she just cracked me up. You
yeah.
know, she would lift her skirts up and pull a flask from her boot and take a drink.
It sounds just like the movies, doesn't it?
Yeah, she was. And then the other woman who I felt sorry for, but, you know, she was a sweet soul, was Louisa Earp, and that was Morgan Earp's wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of her letters that she wrote, her correspondence, her great-nephew gave to me to include in the book that he's never given to anybody before. So you can really read, you know, her. She suffered from debilitative, I guess you would call it fibromyalgia today.
Right.
They call it neuralgia, and, you know, she's sensitive to everything. But she loved flowers, and, you know, she was such a sweet soul. So she sort of touched my heart.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's great. Sherry, thank you so much for visiting with me today. This has been just wonderful. So interesting. And I can't wait to go and read some of those books.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun. Like I said, whenever I can talk about the stuff that I love to write about, you know, you can't shut me up.
And are obviously very passionate about. So.
Well, thank you. I love it.
Well, Sherry does have a website. Isn't it sherrymonahan.com? Am I correct there, Sherry?
That's it.
All right. If everybody wants to check that out, you can see a list of all of the books that Sherry has out already and information on the ones that are coming out this fall that we're all going to want to check out. So, Sherry, again, thank you so much for being on the front porch with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It has been a blast.
For KFRM, I'm Jamie Bloom.